Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan! Monkey tennis?
Love this, my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay. Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, where we continue our road to stratagem, this week by looking at Alan's, Steve's 2008 show, Alan Partridge and Other Less Successful Characters. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Stop.
Nick Alder.
Assess the damage.
And Tom Stab.
Take small steps in the right direction.
So, in order to take small steps in the right direction, aka the new Partridge show stratagem, let's revisit his most recent live work as Alan, I suppose.
Correct.
Yeah. So, a 2008 tour. What else can the group tell us about the circumstances around this show or this tour?
Well, I believe this would have been his first tour since the mega 1998 tour. So that I believe this toured October, November 2008 and was then released on DVD in November 2009. Personally, I saw this at Hammersmith Apollo. I was certain that me, Nick and Adam went to Hammersmith Apollo to see this. Adam, you seem to not remember ever attending.
I believe I did, but this was around the time of my drinking KFC heck. So I can't, I'm not entirely sure that I was there, but I did pick up the DVD in a charity shop a few years back, and it rang some bells. So we've got to assume I was there, but you know, the past is very complicated.
Nick, do you have recollections of attending?
I do, and not to get too much into this, I remember not loving it. A little bit underwhelmed, but I do remember attending, but I can't remember if it was Adam or Stab who attended. But as Adam already pointed out, he was doing a lot of drinking and KFCing at that time.
The Colonel was weighing heavy on my mind. So this was an 86 date sold out tour. So we did talk last week when we covered his previous show that that was more of a 200 date small theatre tour. Whereas I think this is a step towards that kind of comedy is the new rock and roll thing we were talking about, where the venues are getting bigger and the number of dates is getting smaller.
And I didn't see this at Hammersmith Apollo. I remember trying to get tickets for London, failing, and I don't remember if it was just, oh, what else can we get, or whether some extra dates went on sale, but me and my friend Chris went to Oxford to go and see it, and it's the one and only time I've ever got the Oxford Tube. Has anyone got the Oxford Tube, the bus that goes from London to Oxford? They call it the Oxford Tube for some reason, and yeah, I went to go see it in Oxford.
Just tell it like it is, mate, call it a bus. Yeah, the stats on the 1998 tour, The Man Who Thinks He's It, that was, I think just over 200 performances and was, according to Chortle, seen by 350,000 people. So it would be interesting to know how many people this tour played to, because I think you're right, I think there were less dates, but I think the venues were bigger. So whether Coogan was still an even keel in terms of the live audience, because I guess we were quite a few years away from Partridge by this point. There's a bit of a gap there.
Yeah, to some extent, I guess, with perhaps the exception of Saxondale, every character on this tour is kind of a greatest hits type situation at this point, isn't it? No, we haven't heard from any of them that recently. Obviously, we'll talk a bit about the less successful characters. We gain Tommy Saxondale. Do we lose anybody on this tour is anyone not on this tour that was on the previous one?
We lose Tony Farino. So I think we've lost a Farino and gained a Saxondale.
Fair trade.
Looking at the, which is fine. Just looking at the mega timeline, I think Saxondale would have essentially been Coogan's most recent comic creation on air. So I think series two of Saxondale was 2007. So in terms of Alan, the last time Alan would have been seen on television was Anglian Lives in 2003, as discussed a couple of weeks ago here. Then we don't get any Alan on screen until 2011. So, a bit of a fallow period in the world of Partridge here.
In terms of the proportion of Partridge as well, we did talk about this again last week, but Alan made up a smaller segment of The Man Who Thinks He's It. At this point, Partridge, he's definitely the headline figure. He's in the title. He's taking the lion's share of the runtime. And obviously Stratagem is the first time that we'll have a show that's 100% pure Partridge, which did make me wonder if perhaps Stratagem might be a slightly shorter show, whether they can sustain, 90 minutes of pure Partridge. Or whether they're going to have to sort of break it up or cut it down.
Could I just say, based on the ticket price alone, I really hope it's more than 90 minutes.
So do I, but bear in mind, there are a lot of American comics that charge the same amount for a 50-minute show. You've got to hope that...
And that doesn't mean that's okay either, Adam.
No, it absolutely doesn't. We don't like American things when they charge 60 quid and leave after 45 minutes. Sarah Silverman. The other thing I thought was noteworthy just about the DVD of this, which I own thanks to a 49p impulse buy, is that the spine of the DVD, presumably for space reasons, but it just says Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge live. There's not even any reference to the other less successful characters. They know what sells. Yeah, I think they know what sells when you only got a few seconds to quickly scan a DVD spine.
Are there any like comedy quotes on it or anything like that, like The Man Who Thinks He's It DVD?
I spent so long looking at the spine that I don't actually remember if there are any good tidbits from the rest of the packaging. Were there any good comedy quotes or any other bits of information that we'd find useful?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different to the 1998 DVD. Obviously had the Noel Gallagher quote on the front, and, is that a real quote or not? We'll never know. So this one does have genuine quotes from press, and I guess, of course, this DVD release came a year after the actual live shows. But there is quite a lengthy bit from Alan himself on the back that says, humour's very important. A friend of mine had an operation where almost half his lower intestine was removed. I said, how are you? And he said, I'm feeling grammatical. I've got a semicolon. He was using humour.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a weird gag to take up a lot of space on the back of the DVD.
Especially as, don't they basically use that verbatim later on in this show as well? It's taken from the content of this show itself, which is a bit odd.
Yeah, there is quite a nice bit underneath that, though, which says, Whether you're a fan of live comedy, a Coogan lover, or simply one of this country's 3 million unemployed, this is a DVD to be watched over and over again. Oh, that's quite a fun gag. But yeah, the rest of it is just legit. Guardian saying, shamelessly funny, and The Times saying, some of the best laughs I've had all year. His talent for portraying feisty failures is as glorious as ever. We should probably get into the press reaction in more depth later on, I think.
Indeed. So, do we need to talk about some of the less successful characters?
So, much like Alan's previous live, or should say Steve's previous live show, we open with Pauline Calf, and we open with a song about the Marriott Hotel. What are our thoughts on this as an opener?
It's fine.
It's fine. The song isn't that funny, is it? The routine isn't that good.
Just to start, I mean, there's been one quite large change to Pauline over the last few years. She's certainly got an upgrade in terms of her glam, hasn't she?
Yeah.
You're talking about the fake boobs, Tom.
No, I mean, in general, like, there's fake tan going on. Her hair is obviously a lot more styled. Times have changed since the the late 90s, I should say.
One thing I did like is that this song, like all the songs in this show, are well written. Whether they're very funny is another matter, but it's very clear what it's sort of a pastiche of, you know, a kind of Shirley Bassey Bond theme, like kind of classy, diva-ish soul song. And for that part, I think it's very well composed, but whether it's hilarious or hilarious enough to open the show, I'm not totally sure.
I think we talked about production in The Man Who Thinks He's It, and kind of all sort of agreed that the production values of the show are quite high, and I think you're quite right. The song is a kind of like a kind of a Bond-esque sort of anthem, but to answer your question, Adam, it's not funny. That song is not that funny. There really aren't that many jokes in it. It's sort of smirk-inducing, but it doesn't go beyond that. And
a wry smile and a nod, perhaps.
Yeah. And I also feel like the promise of what, and I am jumping ahead slightly, but the promise of what that novel could have delivered from a comedy perspective was just never delivered on.
One thing I did like, and maybe this is partly nostalgia and hindsight as well, is the use that they make of sort of photos of minor celebrities, like the Katonas of this world, like appearing during the, or sort of being referenced during the song. And I guess it's something we see again when Partridge comes up later, you know, in terms of the Kyles, the Llewellyn Bowens, the Feltzes, etc.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, Ross Kemp is a through line of this entire show. They're absolutely doing Ross Kemp at every opportunity.
I didn't find any of this particularly strong, to be honest. The stand up itself, fine. The reading of the book, that section is very poor.
It is,
it's
isn't
not,
it?
It's not. It should have been so good.
It should have been so good. Like the title of the book is Comedy Gold, and it never delivers on the promise of what that book could have given.
The thing about Pauline Calf as a live character as well, it works the same time. Every Coogan live show that I've seen, it's always Pauline reading a romance novel as like the end section of whatever kind of performance she's doing. So in a way that it does feel like, they're not really bringing anything massively new to the table with that. The actual reading thing itself just could have been so much funnier. However, I will say that she shat herself payoff at the end. That that did stay with me. I remember that was, again, one of few highlights pre-Alan in the show, I think. But I don't know, like, it's still not exactly a comedy classic, is it? I also think it's worth mentioning that there is a John Leslie mention here, which doesn't feature much in the Coogan canon, John Leslie, interestingly enough.
Just a quick point. Obviously, calling this show Alan Partridge and Other Less Successful Characters. Now, obviously, the other less successful characters are a bit of a self-referential, you know, self-deprecating dig. But by calling it Alan Partridge and Other Less Successful Characters, you are setting it up for everyone just sitting there waiting for Alan to come on, isn't it, basically? Like, that's what everyone's waiting for. That's what everyone has bought a ticket to see. By opening with this, because I do remember... going and being disappointed when the first thing I saw on stage wasn't Alan.
And then for it very quickly became apparent that we were going to have to wait until the midway point, the break, until we saw Alan. But you are kind of setting yourself up for a bit of a fall by calling it that, I think.
I think that's sort of the point, though, isn't it? Like, I do think that it's obviously very kind of self-aware. And his career at this point was, you know, considerably bigger than what it was. And these characters haven't been touched, really. And so I think that it's quite a knowing, you know, nod to kind of say, look, these might not be as popular as Alan, and Alan has become a much bigger beast. So I sort of
an
think
albatross.
It's yeah, exactly. So I think it's very knowing and very kind of self-referential at that point.
We do see some nipple, though.
You're a bit damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're Coogan, though, because you also can't start the show with Partridge, because then where do you go from there? Or, you know, if the first 45 minutes is Alan, then people are literally just leaving at the interval or something. Like, you know, it has to go this way round. But yeah, I just it's a bit of an unenviable task, I think, because essentially you can't make this show balanced. Even if you have five different characters in the first half, none of them are as strong, even if you're putting them all together.
The idea around Coogan being sort of self-deprecating, self-aware, I think is quite interesting, because I'm sure we'll come on to the finale of this show as well, but it centres around Coogan's awareness of his own sort of reputation or persona. And I think there's something about the naming of this show and about that finale where it's kind of like, I'm not totally convinced he's got the right to sort of comment on his own character in the way that he does. It's kind of like, is it quite accurate for him? You know, I don't know. We'll come on to this in the finale, I'm sure. But I think the other thing is that calling it Alan Partridge and less successful characters is not him accepting that any of the other characters are worse, only that the public's reaction to Alan is better. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's something in the back of Coogan's mind where he's like, I don't actually think Alan is my best character. It's just been the best received.
I think that's a really astute observation, yeah, because it's kind of, essentially, it's the public's fault that they've got it wrong and they haven't made them all as successful.
I mean, that's an assumption.
Yeah,
we don't actually know that, but I don't think anyone's actually, well, in none of the interviews that we've come across, anyone's actually asked him that. So, Steve, come on the show and let's put it to you.
But, you know, it could have been like Alan Partridge and other less loved characters or something. The fact that it's the benchmark is success.
Yeah.
Or kind of commercial achievement.
Or the funniest thing to say would have been Alan Partridge and other less good characters, but I don't think he believes that.
I'm sure he said somewhere something about, I think he's definitely championed Saxondale as one of his favourite characters at various points.
Well, that's a segue, isn't it? Because it's Tommy Saxondale.
Oh, yeah, so it is. Great.
Am I the only one who hasn't seen any Saxondale?
Yeah, I've seen it all.
Yes.
That's mad.
Yeah.
I can't believe you've not seen it.
Yeah. Just never got round to watching it. I did check on iPlayer. It's not available, and I don't and won't have a BritBox subscription.
It's not on BritBox either. I have looked high and low for that show. I don't know why it's disappeared. It's one of those kind of anomalies that you never see it popping up on streaming services. I don't know why, but I would love to rewatch it, but it's just not available, and I refuse to watch and or buy a DVD of it.
Do you think it might be that it isn't on streaming services because it was never that big, so the demand for replay value just isn't there? I think that's
possibly
what it's going to come down to. Like, you know, it's probably in a massive queue of shows the BBC will eventually box out on iPlayer or BritBox or something, but it's not a priority.
Well, put it this way, this section, it hasn't got me rushing out to try and find that DVD.
Saxondale is so much better than this segment, though, because I'd forgotten that Saxondale was a character in this show. So it was a nice surprise when that character came along, and it was just such a disappointment, you know, listening to that character, knowing it is so much better than this. So I would say don't judge Tommy Saxondale on this segment alone.
Do you think as well it's perhaps that all the other characters have kind of more of a natural reason to be on stage presenting or talking to a large audience, whereas Saxondale, it feels a little bit contrived that he's up there in the first place? It's not his environment, you know, it's not the environment. I think where Alan works in lots of different contexts, so you can have him on stage, on the radio, writing a book. Saxondale works as the series Saxondale. It doesn't translate as well to the stage.
I think you're really right. Although, to be honest, it actually, when you break down a lot of these characters, it is that kind of thing where it doesn't really make sense that any of them are on stage to a certain extent, because Duncan Thicket is a rubbish comedian. And
yeah,
honest,
but he's at least a performer, is what I mean. Like Tommy
Saxondale
is backstage crew, basically.
He's just a bloke.
Yeah, and I think, and a lot of the humour, a lot of the appeal of the series is about his sort of interplay with other people. And you put him on his own on a stage talking to an audience that can't talk back, I think you lose a lot of that magic.
Yeah, no, fair. I mean, I thought as well, really, you could, the kind of, how this section all plays out, the kind of slideshow thing and the song and stuff, it's like you could almost get any character doing it because it doesn't really tell you anything about Tommy Saxondale, does it? The link is basically drugs because he's involved in inverted commas rock and roll. But it's I just don't think any of the gags in this were particularly funny. I think it all felt quite dated as well. And I think there are a few gags in there which you just wouldn't do these days. Like, there was a suicide bomber gag in it, which I just felt, that just felt really out of step. In like, one, it didn't really fit with this whole section, but two, I think in 2022, I just seeing that gag, I was like, I just don't think anybody would make jokes like that these days in a big live show like this.
So who's up next? Oh, actually, talking again about songs that are functional and fairly well written, but not necessarily funny, I'd feel the same about Lizzie Q, to be honest. Anyone else agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's a catchy enough hook, isn't it? But again, it comedically...
ultimately pointless.
Comedically, yeah. It just doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, obviously there is a payoff, but it's just not that great, is it? And I mean, yeah, it kind of did make me keen to revisit the Saxondale sitcom, because I don't think I've seen that since it was originally on telly, but as discussed, nowhere to officially view it anymore. But I think that's a fair assessment, that don't judge Saxondale on this 10-15 minute segment, for sure.
Fair enough.
Up next, it's Duncan Thicket then, and I'd be keen to hear what people think, given I was not a fan of it in the last show and would continue that feeling of really not enjoying this. Anyone care to leap to the defence of Duncan Thicket here?
I mean,
yeah, I like the bad ventriloquist dummy bit. The bad ventriloquist dummy bit I thought was good. I enjoyed that. That made me laugh. Where he just ends up shooting it at the end through the curtain.
I absolutely love the Duncan Thicket 1998 set. This doesn't work for me at all.
It's fine. I did like the dummy bit, but that's it. The rest of it is fine.
For me, I do like the concept of this character. I like the kind of, like, you know, he's a shit comedian, and like we discussed, it basically gives Coogan the opportunity to have his cake and eat it, in terms of, like, at a face level, he's telling shit jokes, but at a secondary level, he's kind of mocking whatever the comedic flavours of the time are. But in this 2009 show, there's a kind of level of surrealism he introduces, particularly with the ventriloquist dummy, which I just think kind of took away from what the character should be about. It should be a bit more grounded in terms of, like, you know, he's basically like a rubbish comedian trying to make it. And the fact, yeah, he shoots the dummy, like, that seems to me like they couldn't figure out how to end this segment. Much like the segment in 1998, that ends with him shooting the Simon Pegg bog-eyed character as well. So that just seems a bit... there's just so much repetition, whether it's Pauline Calf reading from a book or Duncan Thicket shooting somebody at the end of a section. It's like, you know, these are 10 years apart, and essentially the grand punchlines, each segment seem to essentially be the same, which I think is odd.
Do you think there's an element of the 1999... when they came to plan this 2008-2009 show, that the 1998 show was the last appearance of a lot of these characters, so they literally went back to what they did then, tried to give it, you know, something of a polish and a reset, but actually didn't change it enough.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair assessment. Yeah, and in fact, actually, let's come to this at the end after we've run through the show. But I don't know if you guys have dug out many of the reviews at the time.
Oh yes,
but that gives some very interesting context to this whole show and the whole writing process around it, I think, which is perhaps somewhat telling why some of this feels a bit lazy and rehashed. So stay tuned for that.
Should we move on to Paul Calf then?
I mean, again, not doing anything for me this at all.
great also, impression of Stephen Hawkins, I will say that.
Yeah,
that was exceptionally good.
It Was a Different Time, Klaxon, again, a whole song about a gypsy lover, not sure.
Yeah.
Also, a song about a gypsy girl, that feels a bit like, that could be like a Tony Farino song.
Mm.
Feels like there are some of these things are kind of interchangeable, like it's Coogan's writing, but
yeah,
actually, like, you know, with Saxondale, his whole shtick could have basically, any of those other characters could do that presentation. And I think Gypsy Girl could definitely be done by Tony Farino or Paul Carf and still be the same, which is,
do you think, perhaps
fine at best.
Perhaps there was an executive decision once Tony Farino was pulled, that he was kind of like, well, yeah, but I really like that song. We could probably give it to Paul.
Genuinely wouldn't surprise me, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, Ross Kemp gets done over again in this segment. So that's yeah. Fun. If he likes camouflage so much, why can't I always see him on my fucking telly? that gets a chuckle every time from me.
Yeah, yeah. There's not much else, though, in terms of comedy highs in this section, I would say.
No, I mean, you've got a Benny Hill-style chase with a wheelchair, and again, that's kind of Coogan having his cake and eating it, because he knows it's not in step with the times, but because it's with the character, he can get away with doing that. I thought there was a line when he says, when are you going to move that fridge off your lawn? That reminded me of Partridge's obsession with Stephen McComb. Is it Stephen McComb that has the fridge on the lawn? So I think it's interesting how some of these ideas get repeated across characters. It's a character like Paul Carf gets to target jokes at gypsies, the working class world, and kind of tell really un-PC jokes in a time where people are kind of assessing whether comedy is PC or not. But yeah, like I say, because he's using the character as the mouthpiece, Coogan gets away with it, basically. But is it actually good? I mean, it was
no.
It was fine. It was just about fine in the late 90s. I think when you get to 2008, Paul Carf, get rid of it.
You heard it here first. Tom Dark says there was a time when all this material was fine.
Yes, in the 90s.
But listeners, if you think differently to us, obviously we've given this a bit of a kicking. If you feel any different about the characters of Paul and Pauline Carf, Duncan Thicket and Tommy Saxondale, maybe this section, not Saxondale in general, because I think the broad assumption is that Saxondale is a good character and is a good series. But if you think differently to us, do let us know.
I would say as well, with Paul and Pauline Carf, like, to be totally open about it, I don't really know enough about the early days of those characters in terms of their origins to kind of it's hard to cast a view on the characters overall. I only really know them from these stand-up shows, so I don't really know what their wider kind of character arcs are like, whereas something like Saxondale was like, yeah, that is a much more interesting quality character in a sitcom format, whereas the others I just genuinely don't know.
Shall we move into the main event?
Are you going to rock us into Forward Solutions, Nick?
Well, yes. And for me, I think the Alan Partridge section opens with what I would probably describe as the comedy highlight of the whole Alan Partridge section, with a kind of, should we call it an inspirational video that's kind of VO'd by Rob Brydon.
So are you effectively saying that the funniest bit of this show is the bit where nobody's on stage?
I mean, I don't want to spoil it and jump ahead, but wow, I was really surprised at how underwhelming this the next 45 minutes were. So let's try and make this chat better than that section, but wow.
I mean, I will say, I think that this VT intro, which is probably, 2 minutes, there is actually a lot to say about it, because there's a lot happening on the screen. There's a lot of information to absorb. And I mean, should we start with the Zen? We have a Zen proverb and then a quote from T.S. Eliot, then a quote attributed to Alan Partridge.
Yes, which is, I like that he is effectively claiming to have come up with the phrase, if you want something doing right, you might as well do it yourself.
Yeah. That is, and what I like about that as well, There's a real warmth to the laughter in the room watching this show back. You can tell how that audience are really willing. Right, this is Alan. This is going to be great.
I also like that the audience laugh becomes the punchline itself when Noel Edmonds appears on screen. Basically, all it takes is a photo of Edmonds and the crowd erupts, which is its own insult, basically, isn't it?
So I've tried to list everybody we see. So let me know if I've
I think I've got a list of it too, so I'll sense check it with you.
Yeah, please do. So I think we've got Gandhi, Martin Luther King, JFK, Churchill, Mandela. Then we move into Tiananmen Square. Then a rocket launching. Then we've got Shakespeare. Then we've got Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat. Then I think, is it Steve Redgrave? We've got an Olympian.
Yep. Yes,
I think
Steve Redgrave. Yeah.
Okay, then Einstein. Then Quentin Wilson from Top Gear.
Brilliant.
Cue laughter.
Great. Here we go.
Mother Teresa. Noel Edmonds. Cue laughter. Princess Di. Is that everyone that features?
I think there's also Vanessa.
Oh, there's another section of characters.
Oh, yeah.
That come up.
There are people coming up who his personal development program has helped, which is
But there's also
before we get to that, you've got words going, Chris. You've got inspiration, positive, vision, leadership, commitment. I think I don't know if I missed any words there, but I thought this really reminded me of what they do with the intro to Mid Morning Matters. Giving a real gravitas to a show that just
doesn't require it.
Yeah,
and you have got Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen and Jeremy Kyle, which are also featured.
Yeah, so those are people he's helped with Forward Solutions, right? Yeah,
as well as Vanessa Feltz,
and Paul Burrell.
Well, yes. Well, they move on to quotes, which are in quotation marks from Paul Burrell, Vinnie Jones. And Ross Kemp. But I thought it was interesting at this point, there's photos of those celebrities and there's a quote, but there's no name under the quote. They're not attributed. And I wondered if this...
Very clever.
At the time, I thought, presumably this means they can't claim on screen that these people actually said these things. But later on in this segment, Alan does directly quote Ross Kemp. So that theory is somewhat out of the window. I wonder if it's more just that they can't put it on screen that Vinnie Jones supposedly said what he said.
In terms of testimonials, you're also forgetting The Cheeky Girls and Ainsley Harriott.
How could I?
And I think Paul Burrell's quote is, "Alan, you are my rock." Vinnie Jones's quote is, "Alan will knock some fucking sense into you." And Ross Kemp is, "Thanks, Alan. You are the ultimate force." Great. That's really good.
I thought, to Nick's point, this is really great, this section. But I also thought it does do a fairly good job of covering the fact we're now... Everyone who's at this show has been watching 45 minutes of characters that aren't Alan. We're now 4 minutes into the Alan section and Alan has still yet to have made an appearance.
I do wonder, I was thinking about this though, and I wonder how much of this is like costume changes and behind the scenes production to basically get him into character was my assumption here.
Well, I think what they did at the live shows, I think the other actors that are quite big parts of this, so Alice Lowe and Steve Oram, I think they did kind of like other skits on stage between characters whilst Coogan was doing costume changes, and they're just not on the DVD.
That rings a bell.
I think that's... Yeah. I mean, I genuinely don't remember that, but I picked that out from a few reviews of the time.
I can't remember if at the time I knew who Alice Lowe was. I might have seen her in... Garth Marenghi by this point, but so I might have recognised her, but Steve Oram I definitely didn't recognise at the time, but only going back and watching this did I then obviously recognise him, because they were in Sightseers together, Alice Lowe and Steve Oram, which is a great film if you haven't
fantastic
seen it.
Fantastic film,
But yeah, he's every time he pops up now, I'm always like, oh, it's your man from Sightseers.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just looking at her filmography, she had a small role in Hot Fuzz in 2007.
She did.
And a few things, like a few bit parts in Mighty Boosh, Black Books, Garth Marenghi, Little Britain, IT Crowd. So yeah, only kind of bit parts and stuff by the time this would have come out, yeah.
I definitely would have recognised her then because I'd seen all of those things by this point.
Yeah. So to move on from the people that the celebrities that have been helped by Alan's personal development programme, there's a really nice series of Vox Pops. One quote I particularly enjoyed was, "Through Alan's Forward Solutions, I've realised there's more to life than friends and family." So that's the takeaway. That's the takeaway here.
Before we do cover more of the public testimonials, I did think that there was one little run of gags in this VT bit, which I thought didn't work very well, which is where he identifies English people, Irish people, Northern Irish people, Scottish people, Welsh people, and you have kind of very stereotypical imagery coming up. And I thought that did seem a bit route one, and I thought the Gibbons seemed better than that. I mean, the crowd, to be fair, the crowd absolutely love it and lap it up, but, you know, it's like... When he says Welsh people and it's a guy with his face pixelated with a sheep, it's like, come on, you can do better.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think the sort of wider takeaway, though, is that I think you can see with this whole section that they're kind of finding their feet with the character. And if you compare it to where they are now with that character, I just, they would never do anything like this. Not just in the interest of taste and kind of decency and whatnot. I just think that they have a much better grasp of how to work with that character now. Whereas I think back then they were probably finding their feet and hadn't really kind of sort of created their own tone of voice for Alan.
I guess it's also kind of like, do some Route One jokes just to get the audience fully on board. Like, you know, that does, yeah, that all those things do get big laughs in the room.
Exactly, so their level.
It's exactly their level. To go back to the public testimonials then, but my first kind of note on this though, a lot of these are badly lit. Some of them are even in the wrong aspect ratio. I just thought, is this bit deliberately bad as like a Pear Tree Productions type joke, or was it done on a rush? Or was it done in a rush or on a budget or something? It's weird how bad quality this little section is, didn't you think?
I didn't clock the aspect ratio, to be honest, but if that's the case, then yeah, that is poor.
But you know, there's like one where it looks like a man standing outside a lift and he's got a shadow over half his face. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I wondered if it was deliberately bad, but I'm not sure that's the sort of gag that would really read for a live show.
I'd like to think that it's because Alan's basically has to chase these people at the end of giving them the chat and getting a vox pop from them in whatever situation he can. But I don't know that it's been given that much thought, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, after doing a bit further research, I did realise, so one of the testimonials, you have the woman in the hijab and they've done the voiceover saying, if these idiots at the BBC knew what they were doing, they would commission a 13-part series TV based on his inspirational talks. So that, I worked out, was filmed on the corner of Oxford Street and Rathbone Place. That is about 2 minutes away from a lot of TV production comedy offices, like around the kind of Tottenham Court Road area. So I think that would indicate this perhaps was done in a rush, because you've got talk back offices about 2 minutes in one direction and you've got the baby cow offices about 2 minutes in the other direction.
A great spot.
They've literally popped out on a lunch break and done that.
Well done. That is an amazing spot.
send the work experience out. Can you film that?
Yeah.
So fresh from inspiring six people at Shelley's Shoes, it's Alan. Finally, we actually get to see Alan. Notable that his dancing girls are called Hot Pot, and also one of his puff flashes fails right away, which I probably should have remembered. It seems I saw this show live, but I did predict at that point that that was going to make an appearance later on and was proven right. Sponsored by Whiskers, probably one of the biggest running gags. I think that's, you know, people who did see this in 2008, that's probably the one thing that everyone remembers because it features so heavily. Also notable that Whiskers is spelled correctly here, presumably so that it can't be claimed that the actual brand Whiskers had anything to do with this.
Yeah.
I remember finding the Whiskers part of the show hilarious at the time. And again, rewatching it, I was like, it's fine. But yeah, I don't know. I was kind of underwhelmed with that whole Whiskers thing. It didn't seem as funny as it did back then.
I agree. I think it was funny in the room, but that's because we weren't expecting it. So I think that's one of those gags that only works on the first viewing.
Do you also?
And again, obviously, because he turns around and it's on the back of the jacket as well, so there's a visual gag as well.
Which ties back nicely to the Castrol GTX reveal as well in I'm in a Partridge. So it kind of, it builds if you know you're Alan. Also, I do think Whiskers was just more of a global powerhouse in 2008. I feel like you don't hear so much from Whiskers these days.
You also have a gag with writing on the back of Tommy Saxondale's jacket in this show. So, yeah, just doing the same old jokes again.
So, straight away, we're treated to a Queen medley. How do people feel this compares to, obviously, Kate Bush is the one that we enjoyed or endured last week?
It's too short to be really considered a medley, because I think it's only two songs, and I feel like either it should be
three.
Okay, it doesn't feel like it's.
Yeah, Don't Stop Me Now, We Are the Champions, and Under Pressure. I think it's just.
Yeah,
those three.
Okay. I mean, I'm feeling fairly underwhelmed by it. It's just Kim kind of singing fairly badly to Queen, which I didn't find hugely funny.
No, it doesn't feel as well considered as something like the Kate Bush medley, which was, you know, that medley is kind of like, I don't know, about six or seven songs. I don't have that in front of me, but that seems like they've really honed in on how to make those songs seg from one to the other. And the fact that we talked about kind of how he makes that such a kind of physical performance. Yeah, this feels a lot more rushed out, and it's almost a bit like, how can we fill 2 minutes and make a reference to some kind of music act that Alan would love, because we've already done Kate Bush, and we've already done ABBA.
As I said last week as well, I think a lot of the humour with Kate Bush is that she's singing in metaphors, but he's acting it out, literally. Whereas with Queen, there isn't that level of subtlety, is there? Like, there's no metaphor. What you hear is what you get with Queen, and everybody kind of knows that. So, you know, the song Under Pressure is about being under pressure. The song We Are the Champions is about celebrating, you know, success. So it's kind of, yeah, it doesn't really work in the same way.
We also get the Glenn surprise me in rehearsals, please line.
Yep.
Which they absolutely love recycling that gag as well. That is featured in so many different iterations of Partridge now.
I would say that the highlight of the Queen medley is the small fart you get when
That's quite funny.
Not funny.
The farting joke is not very Partridge territory, I would say, but it is funny and it does work. And actually,
He does less often attack Inspector's face. He does have form.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah,
and there's Sonia's whoopee cushion as well.
Yeah, that's not necessarily his choice, but again, I see what you mean. And fair.
Do we need to talk briefly about the downsizing of Hot Pot? They were formerly Hot Pot and Red Cabbage, but he had to let Red Cabbage go because of the credit crunch. I mean, am I reading too much into this or being too smutty? Is there a sort of implied joke about one of them being called Red Cabbage and what that implies for hair colour, curtains and cuffs, etc.?
I think you're overthinking it now.
Have I gone too far?
Get your mind out of the gutter.
I felt that very much that Hot Pot and Red Cabbage was, he basically had two brunettes and a redhead, and he's had to make a tough decision because of the credit crunch.
Should we move on to our ahas and the multiple use thereof?
As long as you don't want to dwell on him just basically going, oh, hello girls, getting changed, I don't mind. They do mind. Again, it was a different time.
Isn't this also the point where he says, ooh, bras, and then the missing puff flash goes off and takes him by surprise?
Very enjoyable.
Yeah. That's a nice bit of kind of slapstick comedy, the mistimed puff flash. That's good.
It's fine. I mean, it's...
All right, we're downgrading from really good to fine.
I mean, that's a broad review of the show, isn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, well, I just feel like that kind of like multiple use of ahas. I feel like if you're going to recycle things, that is quite funny to be reminded that Steve basically hates people, you know, using aha in kind of the real world is obviously what you're supposed to kind of read between the lines there. And I do think that I'll never tire of hearing Steve be frustrated about, you know, being bothered basically when people see him kind of in the real world. So that kind of felt like something I was happy to see again.
What comes next after that? Is it him shitting his pants in PC World?
Well, there's a bit before that. Where he says, I enjoy that he says, let me start by taking you back in time to late August. So it's like implied that you're going back years, but obviously not much. And he pictures the scene in Admiral's Cocktail Lounge in Bournemouth. I did look this up. There's an Admiral's Walk in Bournemouth, but sadly no lounge.
Ah, and I believe he is there with Monty Don. Dante, etc., and Alistair Stewart from Police Camera Action, which is a great reference to probably, I guess, in 2008 when it was probably more of a thing. And there's a joke at this point where I was a bit conflicted because I found it funny, but I was like, should I find it funny? Is it appropriate? Anyone remember the Pet Shop Boys joke with the dirty fingers? I felt guilty laughing at it, but I did find it funny.
Yeah. It does feel like it's laced with homophobia, doesn't it? Just a touch.
Yeah. I didn't feel comfortable laughing, but I did find myself chuckling.
Essentially, he's happy for Monty Don to have dirt under his fingernails. He's a gardener. But if you see the same thing with the Pet Shop Boys, he considers it a bit unsavoury.
Yeah.
A different time.
Yeah, but it's not long before he's recovered it with a line that I'm sure everyone can get behind. My mind wandered back to that time 5 years earlier when I shat my pants in PC World. That is, in so many ways, an explosive line. And I also think shat my pants in PC World has got the sort of cadence to it that has been worked on a lot. You know that that's been... It's been shat, it's been pooed, it's been messed, it's been pants, it's been trousers, it's been PC World, it's been curries, it's been, you know, they've probably been through every combination, like a Richard Scarry book of how that sentence could be constructed. And I think shat my pants in PC World, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, it is good. And you know, again, the audience, they do love that line as well. Like, that goes down quite massively.
Followed up quite quickly with 5 years ago, nobody gave a damn about Wales. Now they make Doctor Who there, which I thought at this point I started to really feel like you could really see the difference between this and 98 Live Alan. This feels much more tailored. I think there's been a bit more care, and the material at this point, at least, I think is quite a bit punchier.
Yeah, a little bit. I guess
they're kind of inhabiting, like, just Alan as a character is in such a different place here, because I guess in 98, you know, you're in the thick of it between the I'm Alan Partridge series, so it's all about that, still want to be a successful chat show host, and it kind of, I think, it almost kind of writes itself at that point in the late 90s, whereas here, you've got, he's been away for so long, you need to create a bit of a backstory and kind of, I think, add a bit more detail to the character, which I think is exactly what the Gibbons start to do here, yeah.
There's a nice bit where he, as he often does, loses an argument with himself, imagining what the audience might be asking at this point. Yeah, always nice to see him try and imagine someone else's viewpoint and basically end up losing an argument on his own.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So after shatting himself in PC World, Alan basically checks into an Ibis in Canary Wharf and pays £14 to watch Billy Elliot, which I must admit I did enjoy because I could really kind of imagine that. But upon watching Billy Elliot, this was the thing that kind of inspired him to change, and that's where we get Forward Solutions Management. We also hear from some testimonials. Does anyone have any notes on that?
I've got bullet-headed Ross Kemp, the TV tough guy.
Yeah, bullet.
Again, do stick the knife into Ross Kemp there, Steve.
I also enjoyed that research shows Ross Kemp's audience is mainly bold men in their 30s that share rented accommodation with a dangerous dog.
That was brilliant. That was so good.
Yeah, I've nailed that.
That's absolutely Ross's level.
Yeah. Is James Hewitt?
Yeah.
Do you then have the Burt Kwok Ken Hom Hot Wok Got Gwan endorsement?
And then the kind of like the build on that when he kind of says, but seriously, what Kong showed, and he's now calling him Kong again.
My notes at this point say this ranks highly amongst bits that wouldn't work now. And also, if you look closely, this is the closest Coogan comes to corpsing as well. He's on the verge of breaking in this section, I think.
Yeah, it's.
I also wonder, in a lens of 2022, would you do this?
I don't think you would.
Much like you saying the Pet Shop Boys thing, like. Because it is funny because I think what makes it funny is the quick exchange, like rattling through all those different names and getting it wrong. But obviously there is quite a kind of racial undertone that makes it feel a little bit awkward viewing now, I think.
I think you'd have to work differently, arguably work harder in 2022.
yes.
But I did enjoy the line, you can guarantee when Paul Burrell tells you something, it will be 65% true.
That is good. That's good.
You also get as we mentioned earlier, the semicolon joke at this point as well, which is good, but as we've said, printed in full on the DVD cover. So unless you were there live, if you bought this on DVD, you've read the joke already.
It comes out of nowhere, right? Like, there's no context to this. I think this joke just kind of, it's as if they had the joke and they just had to get it in there. There's no setup to it.
It's so weird. It's not even that good, but it's in the live show and on the DVD
case. I think the joke is actually... sorry, but I do think the joke is good, but because it comes out of nowhere and it's not really part of the sort of supporting narrative, it doesn't it's inexplicable as to why it's there. It's just like, oh, this is a good joke, we've got this, let's just put it in there.
The only reason I could think that it was on the DVD cover was perhaps there had been some sort of marketing decision that it's been 3 years since I'm Alan Partridge was on TV. People need an extra little nudge to remind themselves of, like, the brand of humour. Like, somebody looks at the front cover, they're like, oh, Alan Partridge, quite enjoyed that. Turn to the back, read a joke from Alan. Yes, this is funny, I'll buy it.
But it's a joke that centres around some quite basic wordplay. So, again, it's one of those jokes. Any one of these characters could tell that joke in their segment and it would... in yeah. essence, work.
It is baffling.
It's weird.
I mean, and also yeah. talking about very basic wordplay, there's then the joke about the iPhone and the Wii being combined to be the YI, yeah. which I was a bit like, no, that's rubbish. Not having it.
Yeah, and this is basically what the Digiwall is now, right? Like, you can see they've really honed that kind of style of humour, and it really works in the Digiwall. And I feel like there were multiple occasions where this kind of, like... It was quite funny that it was rubbish tech, and like the gauntlet was quite funny. Also nice to be reminded what Windows XP looked like, but other...
yeah, really enjoyed
other
that.
And also nice to have some airtime devoted to Jimmy Nail, who supposedly developed the YI with Alan yeah. and Intel. Now, I mean, presumably his name's only come into it because of where he's from, and that justifies the YI name. But I did look into Jimmy Nail a little bit. He really disappeared. He retired... but came back for a play with Sting about the shipyards that they both grew up on, but ended up not reprising the role in Newcastle, and that was it. But if you look at Jimmy Nail, he had no acting experience. He ended up on a show getting 10 million viewers. He then had a number one single, and he was then in Evita with Madonna. That is a life.
He was in Evita?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I've learned fair something
play,
tonight.
Yeah. Fair play, Jimmy Nail.
Lovely crocodile shoes.
Hey everyone, producer Jed here. Just another note to say that the boys miss something. The fact that Jimmy Nail, especially Crocodile Shoes, is very apt to our particular circle, because Jimmy Nail is my dad's best friend and he named the lead character of Crocodile Shoes after me. Google it!
Before we go further into the interactive glove section, just quickly, did you guys get down the list of things that once broken can't be fixed?
I know Hyman's is in there.
Light bulbs? Is that?
You've gone straight for the big punchline there. Yeah, you've got light bulbs, Amstrad Hi-Fi, and Hyman's.
Great.
We can now go back to the interactive glove section.
I think this section, we're entering a period of, for me, fairly lacklustre humour, and the gauntlet is in part to blame for this just not working. Because this whole section, you know, is kind of Alan using interactive tech, I think, to try and make some kind of point about Ford Solutions. I mean, I'm still not really clear what the hell Ford Solutions even is, having watched this section. And obviously, that is part of the joke. But I didn't find much of this particularly funny, where we start to find out some examples of kind of positive people.
Yeah, I thought this bit felt very flat to me. And I don't know if in 2008, 2009, it was better, because I feel like the celebrities, for want of a better word, that he uses in this section just don't feel like great punchlines. Like Trevor Phillips, Bernard Matthews, fine. I mean, it's quite funny the fact that he just goes with a character named CSI Charles Brownlow from The Bill, because he doesn't know his actual name.
Yeah.
The guy's real name is actually Peter Ellis, who was in The Bill for 16 years. But it's just... they just don't feel like great targets. It's like Ross Kemp, yes. Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen, yes. Like
better.
Those things make more sense, and they feel more part of like the world of Partridge. And I don't know, maybe these felt like more significant names back in 2008, but
maybe
again, much like you say, sure. Nick, as well. It just, I mean, I know part of the joke is you come away from this whole thing going, you don't really understand what Forward Solutions is, but this whole section just doesn't do any job. I don't think.
I do agree, although I enjoy the inclusion of Bernard Matthews because he's mentioned elsewhere in the APU. He yeah. actually died 2 years after this show went out as well, so this is arguably at its peak. And I did like, I mean, this is a bit of an obvious one, but I did like the line where he's kind of like, he really does have chicken's best interests at heart. I was chatting to him about this at a cockfight in his front room. And yeah. there's a whole bit about sort of, there's a whole kind of confused bit about whether they're referring to chickens or ladies, which brings me to today's quiz, chicken or your lady. I've got nine names. Some of them are chicken breeds. Some of them are the names of genuine Greek princesses. Chicken or lady? Number one.
Brilliant.
Group
consensus?
Yeah, group consensus. Evgenia.
Evgenia.
I'm going to go for chicken or lady. Greek princess would be my.
I was going to say chicken.
Oof.
I was going to say chicken.
Let's go Greek.
It's the Greek princess, correct. Number two, Tirana.
Chicken.
Sounds like Vic Reeves on Shooting Stars. Chicken.
Uvavu, it's chicken. Number three, Campine.
C-A-M-P-I-N-E.
Campine.
That feels chickeny to me, guys.
That feels chickeny to me.
It's chicken through and through. Number four.
Ooh, we're 3 for 3.
Ekaterini.
Princess.
Greek princess.
Correct, that's a princess. Number five, Cotentine.
Cotentine.
Can we spell it?
Yeah, C-O-T-E-N-T-I-N-N-E.
Princess, do you think? Could be either way.
I think, I'm going chicken.
I feel like chicken tonight.
It's chicken tonight. Number six, Limousine.
Limousine?
Limousine, spelt
princess.
Exactly as you'd expect.
A limousine chicken? No, I don't think you'd have a limousine chicken, would you?
Princess limousine?
Is it
limousine chicken coming to Tesco's near you?
Is it princess limousine or is it chicken princess? Limousine?
Princess.
It's a chicken. Oh, you were doing so well.
Oh.
Number seven, Kaikilia.
Princess.
Goddess. Princess even. Goddess. Princess.
We've upgraded to goddess. Okay. We're going to goddess.
It's a princess. Number eight, the penultimate chicken slash lady, Yamuna. Y-A-M-U-N-A.
Oh, Yamuna. Chicken.
Okay, chicken, let's go.
It's a chicken. And finally, number nine, Alexandria.
Now.
Could go either way.
Is he trying to trick us in?
That really could be either, couldn't it? I'll tell you what, this must be a great listen.
I'm going chicken.
Okay, fine. Chicken it is.
He's tried to bamboozle us.
Yeah, and he has successfully bamboozled you because Alexandria is both a Greek princess and a chicken breed.
We're all winners.
Well, we didn't know we could give that as an answer.
Thanks for playing.
Fine, chicken or princess. will that be back next week as a new regular feature?
It will be, because as Jimmy Dale said to Alan, I didn't fuck a boot. And he didn't. He really didn't. So we're at the point now where the jokes about the mistaken rude pick appearing come up. Keen for Nick's thoughts on this, because I thought this was quite funny. In 2022, it feels like a bit obvious. Is it funny, Nick? Is it funny?
No, it's not, because again, much like the gauntlet is, not how it should be done, and the digiwall is how it should be done. I think what they did with this time, where you saw him in the garden with his kind of dirty boy outfit, the picture of Michael, him in the car. So the way that he did that in this time is, yes, that's how to do it. This with just like random sex pictures, you're just like, no, it's not funny. For me, it didn't work.
But do you think, I would imagine it probably was funny in the room at the time, but I think with the benefit of hindsight of seeing this joke done much better in this time, we're able to go, it's not great.
I also think even if the scrolling and the kind of BDSM imagery isn't funny in and of itself, him having to say whiskers to get rid of it, I think, is the bit that was worth
the trouble. That's
good. Like a safety word.
Yeah, and also just a great association for the brand.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it time for Alan's caring hands?
Yeah, it is. Enter Jackie and Jackie Tootle.
I mean, I assume the first point that we're going to touch on is the lengthy kiss, which you get no real sort of further explanation. Or that's not quite true, but I think the explanation that you do get is unsatisfactory and doesn't lead me to find that joke particularly funny.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think, that there is something of a history around this period of Partridge of oddness for its own sake. For example, sawing up his cereals outside the Static Caravan. But it would work better if it was tied back to some sort of meaning.
Yeah. Again, I don't know what everyone else thinks, but this section, this is not good. And I feel like so much of this humour, or the climactic part of this joke is to do with the tech kind of not failing as such, but a prompt kind of coming up on the screen where Alizar Stefanik.
Do you want a bigger penis? Pop
yeah,
up
and them? Like that joke takes quite a while to resolve itself and pay off, and it's not that funny. I think the only kind of thing that would probably explain it and maybe make it funnier in 2008 is, you know, pop-ups were a thing and they're probably less of a thing now with the way that kind of just technology's moved on. So it's like, yeah, I remember that. It was quite funny. But good God, like the payoff to that joke is not strong enough and it takes too long to get there.
I partially agree, but I think, again, like the BDSM imagery, the funny bit with that was him having to say whiskers to get rid of it. With this, the kind of penis ad and him accidentally ordering it is one thing, but the bit I did enjoy was where he's sort of composing the email to them afterwards and he's going back and editing his own choices, big to bigger, happy to very happy, cock to genital cock, which is really funny because, like, does he think they would mistake it for a cockerel? Is that the joke? You know, length, girth, you know, all that sort of thing. I thought that bit kind of, if they just left it as the basic gag, it would have felt a bit lazy, but I think they did try to go the extra mile and add a sort of a secondary punchline to it.
Yeah, I'd agree with Adzi on that. I enjoyed it.
Should we review Alan's 1992, where interestingly he also talked about his 1992 in the previous live show, because it was the Amstrad presentation year. He won a boat and also his wife left him, but soon came back. So he says here,
dinghy.
Yeah, that's it. So he says here, 1992 was a good year for him. It's when he got VAT registered, his wife lost weight, and also his noisy neighbour had a stroke.
Yeah.
So just getting a bit more detail there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, he's effectively claiming that he knows how Jackie feels. Where Jackie raped effectively?
The guy.
I mean,
burgled. And
They're both Jackie. Bound, burgled, and buggered. And then he says he knows the feeling. But all he has to qualify that is that he had his mortgage application turned down.
Yeah.
Well, I think you can kind of layer in. We've seen all the kind of S&M photos, so perhaps that's. That's been layered into that gag, but I don't think that really reads that immediately in the room, as it were.
No, there's a kind of a nice bit of wordplay where Jackie starts saying, "What's interesting is," and then he says, without knowing what she was going to say, "What's more interesting is," and then goes into his own story. So,
let's talk about
and it's a bit of a precursor to him sort of cutting off Psychic Simon, talking about his like adoption and things like that, isn't it? That he just just waiting for his opportunity to tell his story.
I mean, I'm kind of with Nick on this section. Like, it's not great, but then I do think the overarching gag with this whole thing is that you never hear how or why anyone's actually benefited from Forward Solutions, because they never get to make
it. We don't even
know
what it is yet.
Because Alan always interrupts.
Well, be fair, they got a free tin of Fish Symphony cat food between them.
I did love that. I did think that was actually quite funny. The idea of a Whiskers kind of flavour being described as a Fish Symphony, I actually thought was very funny. Is it time to discuss what Forward Solutions actually is? I mean, I think we've been going for about half an hour at this point, and we still don't know what it is.
It definitely is time to hone in on the central thesis of Forward Solutions. But did anybody, before the logo started firing explosive sperm around the screen, did anybody notice that it was shaped like a cock and balls?
No.
No.
But of course it is. And so, yes, Forward Solutions, much like his tactics in The Man Who Thinks He's It, is a three-point plan. We've covered this at the top of the episode, but it's stop. Assess the damage, take small steps in the right direction. Obviously, there's lots of humour to be wrung out of this. One thing I enjoyed is that his three-point system in The Man Who Thinks He's It was very much about making the best of or making the most of your potential. Now, that's been downgraded very much to just recovering from a fuck-up that's already happened.
Yeah.
that's really good, actually. Yeah, assess the damage. So something's already gone catastrophically wrong.
Yeah.
And obviously the fact that the third point, take small steps in the right direction. Well, how many steps? What are those steps? How do they work? You know, that basically should be what Forward Solutions is all about, but it's glossed over as one bullet point.
And, I mean, reading somewhat between the lines and who knows / who cares, but this feels like it's entirely come out of this PC world mishap, right? This isn't actually a kind of like a point around how to kind of, you know, empower yourself as a person. This is, if you shit yourself in PC world, these are the steps that you need to take.
Yeah, there's very much a scenario here where he, shuffling out of PC world with shit all over him, is thinking to himself, do you know what? This actually is quite a good advice just for life.
Yeah. I think we kind of enter again another bit of a weak section where the gauntlet kind of rears its head again, and you kind of get Alan with a kind of a shotgun sort of blasting away, you know, negative feelings. And then there's a kind of like point where you see various people from Hitler and JFK. And I don't know what we all thought, but again, I just think this is not strong, this section.
I agree, and I feel a bit like this was almost in there just to kind of tick off some touch points that people recognise from other Partridge. So he's shooting shitty zombies, which we've, you know, people have recently heard about from Iron Man and Partridge. And
you say recently, that's still about, what, 6 years after the fact?
Well, that's true.
It's not even that recent.
And once again, a bit like Forrest McAllister, he basically has to exit the stage having shot someone by accident.
Yeah, but it was a bit... Not that funny, and it's like, yeah, he shot JFK, but it's like, well, he didn't shoot JFK. There was just a bit of a technical glitch, but it's sort of played out as if he's actually kind of caused, you know, harm to someone. And I agree, they're riffing on that kind of Forbes McAllister thing, but yeah, ultimately, it doesn't pay off.
I think it's actually, perhaps it's because I think in the world of Alan, these kind of punchlines centering around him having a conversation with Hitler and then JFK, I just don't think they really work. If this was like Ross Kemp and Paul Burrell or something, definitely, it would actually be much funnier. Now, obviously, the concept would have to change slightly because, you know, fine, you're shooting JFK, which is reenacting what happened to JFK. But I just think Alan going into kind of legitimate historical figures as targets... In terms of like punchlines, I just doesn't feel like it really gels with everything else we've seen and known of the character up to this point.
I think it's part of the character that he is has an interest of some kind in history. But I genuinely, I've got in my notes here, is Alan's love of history something the writers keep pushing? It doesn't actually make for great Alan content. Does anyone want an Alan historical documentary? Isn't that itch better scratched by non-Alan projects like The Witchfinder in the Gibbons or and Armando Iannucci's books? And I think it's relevant to this next section, the play about Sir Thomas More as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting. I've also kind of noticed that. I feel like Alan being a history buff is perhaps something the Gibbons team introduced. I don't really feel like that was a strong part of the character before. I feel like this is the first time this is really brought to the fore, having this play, this I Am More play, which I think we can all agree isn't that great either.
Yeah, and I totally agree on that. But what I would say is, again, much like the Digital War, the Gauntlet, when you have things in Mid-Morning Matters with like King and Carr, and they're talking about, you know, Henry VIII driving a Range Rover Evoque and Alan getting kind of very excited about that and going, yeah, absolutely. And the confusion with Oliver Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell, there's moments where this has worked. But I think the big thing to say here with this play is, because we've seen the play work with Hannigan and, you know, that's executed very, very well. This is quite long and frankly, a bit of a humour vacuum. There's actually very little humour or it's quite an odd choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I think as one of the things here is that it's one of the first examples of the humour coming from Alan's editorial choices, like Pear Tree and Oasthouse stuff. But I don't know that translates very well to a live show. I think there's a lot of exposition at the start that's quite funny, but no one's laughing. It kind of goes over the audience's heads. And yeah, for every kind of bit that's quite funny, there's a misfire, I think. I liked the accidental whiskers coming up on the back screen when they're talking about Catherine of Aragon's top lip. And so the sponsorship comes up. And I like later on when it becomes obvious that the play is sort of a vehicle for him to push forward solutions again. But yeah, the kind of historical aspects of it don't land, I don't think.
I think what's actually interesting with the benefit of hindsight and further Coogan Gibbons work is actually, I think the more you know about the character, I think what they've layered in is essentially he's like a wannabe history buff. So doing this thing around Thomas More, who was a key historical figure around the time of Cromwell. So I think basically what there's a very long drawn out gag that the Gibbons have established is essentially Alan's historic knowledge begins and ends with the fact that he read Wolf Hall. So Wolf Hall is about Thomas More and Cromwell and stuff. And it was a hugely successful novel, I think, in like the 2014-15, something like that. It was a TV show then. So I think around the time of this tour, I think it was a very successful novel. So I think they've taken that kind of through line through to Mid-Morning Matters and other stuff, where it feels to me like Alan has basically read one book, which is a historic novel, and that's all he knows.
It felt to me as well like this didn't really get going until the play is somewhat unraveling, and it's about Alan struggling to make it work. Like when he drops his lute and then his chair, I thought that was quite a good bit of physical comedy, and he gets stuck in a loop and he's like, unhand me, I'm Roger Moore, shit, I've done it again. And I thought this is a rare occasion where enough people have allowed one of Alan's projects full budget, full cast. He's been given himself enough rope to hang himself, or in this case, show that he's not capable of a 5-minute play. And then he obviously goes off stage, thinks the mic's off. You hear him saying it's a fucking disaster, which I thought was good, because I think one thing we do all love is backstage Alan. And it's quite hard to get that in a show where he's supposedly presenting to you in real time. So that bit I quite enjoyed. I also thought it was interesting at the end that they impaled his head on a spike.
Yeah, that's a nice little callback, isn't it, that I think fans of Alan will kind of really appreciate.
I mean, I did like the kind of ending gag here where he says he was voted the 37th greatest Briton, 9 places ahead of Boy George. And I feel like Coogan and the Gibbons have targeted the banality of these lists at other points as well.
And targeted particularly accurately, because this actually did happen in 2002. Yeah, he was named 37th greatest Briton, and he was 9 places ahead of Boy George. Sounds like the sort of thing they've made up.
Like, what does it mean? It has no actual significance. And I quite like that they've taken the piss out of that. But again, it isn't worth the whole 5-minute play just to get to that one gag.
Also, I mean, the biggest disappointment of the play for me is that this is the end of the Alan section, and it effectively ends with him closing his eyes and sort of being deflated in video. He's not even on stage at the end of his own show.
I think some of this is,
and he's not even Alan. He's Alan being somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It feels like it's gone. It's quite far removed from what the audience want to see. Although I will say, if we can just move on from Alan into the sort of quote unquote Steve Coogan finale, I did enjoy this a lot.
Yes,
I thought this was very funny. There's a gag, obviously, in it that's repeated in one of his dream sequences in The Trip, where somebody comes along reading a paper that says Coogan is a cunt, and then it unfolds, it's The Guardian, it unfolds again and says Dad. It does feel, I like it because it feels risky, and it feels a bit controversial that Steve is sort of talking at length about his own kind of misgivings. And he doesn't really go that hard on himself, does he? Like, he sort of alludes to being a bit of a naughty boy, but ultimately the song is about how he's been hard done by, effectively.
Yeah, I guess so, because it sings like tall tales of cocaine, largely but not completely fabricated.
Stories
of strippers, some exaggerated.
Yeah, I mean, that bit's funny because it's kind of like he's saying, you know, the drugs, they did, that was unfair. The strippers, you know, that's probably okay. I thought it was really funny. I like the sort of combination of the kind of like meek, well, I guess kind of Laurel and Hardy-esque sort of end of the pit kind of show, you know, kind of show tune with the amount of times you hear the word cunt.
Yeah.
I do think the opening, well, the kind of the line that starts this with him saying, the policeman saying, I read somewhere that you're a bit of a cunt. Like, that absolutely destroyed me at the live show. I laughed so much because you just don't know that that's what's coming. I thought that was exceptionally well done. Also, I like the bit with the newspaper at the beginning, because he then says, it's The Guardian, sir. So obviously Coogan can't knock it because it's a left-leaning newspaper, I thought was quite fun.
And again, like with Whiskers, they spelt Guardian with I-E-N at the end because they can't use the actual name.
Yeah, but that's also the long-running joke that there are always typos in The Guardian. That's something that Private Eye do as well. They always deliberately misspell it.
So yeah, with the revelation that everyone's a bit of a cunt sometimes, but crucially we've all misjudged Steve Coogan, that brings us to the end of the show. I thought it's an interesting way to end. It's quite brave to not end with Alan and to sort of, you know, show a bit of a look under the bonnet. But in terms of the show as a whole, let's talk a bit about the, I wouldn't say critical mauling, but it's certainly been knocked around the cage a little bit by the press reviews, hasn't it?
I mean, I would say reading these, it's that sort of thing, like where you know reads like a 4 or something. I think these read like a 2, and but they've all given him a 3. I think when you know the actual critical breakdown is, they are fairly quite harsh on him, but I think overall, like, you know, when you get the takeaway, like, out of 5 rating, they weren't too harsh. But I mean, I think what was most interesting finding the old reviews about this is that he was massively under rehearsed for the first half of the tour. Yeah, so like in October 2008, these are Chortle reviews. Steve Bennett writes, he stumbles over his words several times and keeps glancing at clipboards. This might still be early in the tour, but when you've got 1,800 people paying just shy of £40, you shouldn't still be practicing. It then goes on, shame the hesitant first half didn't live up to the brilliant second. Despite some sparkling moments and plenty of mid-level chuckles, the scenes without Partridge didn't have the sense of occasion you'd expect of one of Britain's biggest and best comedy stars making a comeback after a decade away. And then Chortle went on to review it when it got to London in November. And, you know, it's essentially, it doesn't read to me like it progressed massively. They're still saying it's a show of 2 halves. The superlative Alan Partridge plus a collection of characters that are not only less successful but woefully less funny. And they really stick it in here. The once brilliant creations either tread water or sink miserably. If they were launched on today's comedy circuit in this state, it's unlikely you'd ever have heard of the likes of Pauline Calf or Tommy Saxendale. Yeah, and I mean, they literally also say it's a shoddy first half, but it's a slick and funny second half.
I mean, I think that's a pretty well observed, you know, review, to be honest. I mean, I do remember being fairly disappointed with it, but I do think that, you know, those characters kind of have no right to be as popular as they are. If you just take it as a kind of like, you know, a show of the less successful characters, they are not good enough to be performing to that many people for that price.
I can give you a quick roundup of the other reviews as well. So that was all Chortle stuff that I just read there. But The Guardian basically ran a piece in October 2008, which was kind of basically an amalgamation of other reviews. So The Telegraph found the whole experience a bitter disappointment and called it a mediocre shambles. They wanted to say the script itself, most of it felt as if it had been written on the bus on the way to the gig.
Ooh, ouch.
And The Times wrote that it had a scrappy structure and an under-rehearsed star, but praised the wit of a short play about Thomas More and half-wished the entire show was about Alan Partridge. Well, good for Dominic Maxwell of The Times. His dream is about to become a reality.
I wonder as well, I mean, I don't think any of these are completely inaccurate, but I wonder that if reviewers, you know, have their pens/knives out a little bit for Steve Coogan, just because previous shows have sort of, you know, made a bit of a mockery of how much he doesn't care or how much he does care about reviews. And I feel like people, he can be sort of prickly, I think, in his sort of reactions to the press and his relationship with the press, and or certainly, you know, some newspapers. And I think it's rare that people get an opportunity like this to sort of to really stick the knife in. I'm not saying that they weren't right to do that. I don't think it's as bad as these reviews say. I think the non-play Partridge and the finale are both, I enjoy them a lot. I think they're pretty great. I think the opening half had some nice moments, but it wasn't kind of, I mean, I think, again, perhaps I'm being softer on it because I'm watching a 49p DVD rather than you know, imagine going back to spending 40 quid to sit in, you know, to travel to sit in front of it. But
I think particularly, you know, I mean, it's kind of an error on Coogan's part that they've had reviewers in on a night when he's reading a script off of a clipboard in front of a paying audience. It's like, well, you're going to get a critical mourning for that, and you've brought that upon yourself. So yeah, the reviews once he'd actually learnt the script are a bit more favourable, I guess, to be fair.
I mean, you've got to hope that he's learned his lesson by stratagem, because, again, you know, we've gone from 200 dates to 86 dates. I think stratagem is going to be something like 20 to 30 shows. So there isn't time to learn on the job. It's got to be ready night one, hasn't it, really? So does anyone have any final thoughts about Alan Partridge and other less successful characters? Perhaps sum the show up in a sentence, word or noise.
Disappointing.
I'll go with fine.
I'll go with broad agreement that this is fine.
Yep, I would say a mixed bag, but the bag is leaking.
And it's full of Fish Symphony.
A bitter fish symphony. That's life.
Oh, very good.
I think the whole thing is kind of like we've discussed looking back at all these shows, is it just feels like a full-on Alan live show is definitely the correct way to go. You know, from lessons in life management to bouncing back to forward solutions, that as a style and a format makes sense. The fact we've gone from half an hour of Alan to 45 minutes of Alan. So I think if they stick to a forward solutions type thing and don't try and do Alan doing a historical play, if they work around that idea, hopefully Stratagem's going to be good and hopefully Steve is rehearsed up.
Indeed. So yes, join us on the final step of the road to Stratagem, arriving at Stratagem Central, stopping at Shattered Dreams Parkway, and hopefully not inflated ticket price Parkway as well. If you've got any thoughts on this show or you've got any predictions for Stratagem or you want to talk a little bit about the man who thinks he's it, please do get in touch. Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, Facebook.com/The Partridge Pod, or email thepartridgepod@gmail.com, or leave us a voice note on the Monkey Tennis Hotline 07923 600 017. If you've enjoyed what you've heard and want to chuck us a couple of quid to say thanks, we'd much appreciate it at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. And if you're Steve Coogan listening and you think that we've been a little bit harsh on the show, don't worry, Steve, everyone's a bit of a cunt sometimes. Thanks and goodbye.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dad!
Monkey tennis?
Love pierced my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
Lad, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.